cure it, you can't fix it, you can't stop it, but you've got one thing over it. It doesn't hurt. You don't need medicine, you just need a mind.
No triumph, no tragedy. Tuesday morning at 9, over on BBC Radio 4.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's just gone 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by David Cornett.
The Unite Union has said it's postponing a ballot of British Airways cabin crew so that it can consider a new offer on pay and conditions that was put forward by the airline last week. The dispute has caused 22 days of strike action so far this year and cost BA more than £150 million. The latest offer includes a guarantee that basic salaries will rise over 2 years. Unite's joint leader Tony Woodley said he couldn't recommend the offer because the airline was refusing to reinstate travel concessions to staff who went on strike. BA said the offer was fair and reasonable. The Work and Pension Secretary, Ian Duncan Smith, has said he wants to offer unemployed people incentives to leave their council homes and to relocate to areas where there are better job prospects. He says too many people have become trapped because they don't want to leave an area for fear that they may lose their homes. The Shadow Education Secretary and Labour leadership candidate Ed Balls says the policy is deeply unfair. Securing global financial stability will top the agenda at the G20 summit in Canada. But there are tensions as some European countries, including the UK, want to cut state spending, which the US says could jeopardise economic recovery. England has a fully fit team for this afternoon's World Cup second round match against Germany. It's the first time the two sides have met in the tournament since Italia 90, when their semi-final went to penalties. Germany have never lost a shootout in the tournament. China's leading contemporary artist, Wu Guangzhong, has died. He was 90. In 1992, he became the first living Chinese artist to have his paintings exhibited at the British Museum. Wu Guangzhong's trademark Chinese landscapes combined delicate Eastern ink techniques with Western oil painting methods. And the weather, it'll be the hottest day of the year so far across southern parts, with temperatures reaching 30 Celsius in the London area and the mid to high 20s elsewhere in the south. There'll be some warm sunshine further north, but scattered showers across Scotland and Northern Ireland. BBC News and Weather at approaching 1:03.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now it's time here on Radio 3 for the Early Music Show, presented by Catherine Bott.
The otherworldly sound of Alessandro Moreschi, the last castrato, on a very scratchy-sounding recording made in Rome more than a century ago. It's not a sound we're familiar with these days, of course, as the practice of carrying out surgical procedures on young boys in order to preserve their angelic voices has, I'm delighted to say, long since died out. There are still plenty of male singers who cherish and perform the music written for castrati, though, and we'll be hearing from some of them throughout today's programme, which is dedicated to boys who sing high. Names like Farinelli and Senesino crop up on the early music show all the time, but this year marks the 200th anniversary of the death of an equally renowned singer from the next generation, Venanzio Rauzzini. Rauzzini's career took him to royal courts, opera stages and concert platforms all over Europe, but he spent the last 30 years of his life in southwest England, here in the city of Bath. He became an integral part of Bath's musical and social life in the late 18th century, and the city is still rightly proud of his achievements, so much so that the Bath Philharmonia held a memorial concert at the Abbey in April to mark his anniversary. The concert included arias which were written especially for Rauzzini, and the star of the show that evening was the Moldovan male soprano Radu Marian, here performing this charming little ditty by Albinoni.
Mm-hmm.
Nulla spero e nulla bramo. I expect nothing and I desire nothing. An aria from Albinoni's pastoral serenata, Il Nascimento dell'Aurora. It was performed there by the Klemencic consort, and the role of Zefiro was sung by the male soprano Radu Marian, who gave a concert here in Bath Abbey earlier this year. Quite an astonishing sound, I'm sure you'll agree. I'm joined now by someone who attended that concert. Well, more than that, he gave the pre-concert talk beforehand. He's a real expert on Venanzio Rauzzini and the time Rauzzini spent here in Bath. Welcome to the very distinguished singer Raymond Herrinks. Raymond, you are a hugely successful singer yourself, but I'm intrigued to know why someone with such a commanding, fruity bass baritone voice, why did you become so interested in a singer at the opposite end of the scale? What is it about Rauzzini that draws you to him?
Well, first of all, that he had a rather wicked reputation in Europe, and he had to leave Europe, there's no doubt, because he had rather too many liaisons with eminent young women and young noble women as well. His singing was apparently phenomenal in the sense that the lower part of the voice was considered very, very beautiful, and it had a very attractive, creamy quality. The middle was impressive, but the top astounded everybody.
He lived here for 30 years, and he was obviously quite a celebrity. Now, I'm getting a sense of this fame, because in a corner of Bath Abbey, where Raymond Herrinks and I are currently snuggled on a rather cold stone bench, is what's called a tributary memorial to Rauzzini. And it was erected by two of his favourite pupils just after his death in 1810, 200 years ago. And it reads in part, "Near this place rest the remains of Venanzio Rauzzini, native of Rome, distinguished as a vocal performer on the continent and in England, whose judicious abilities for 30 years in conducting the musical department of this city amply gratified the applauding public, and whose ever gracious deportment conciliated their zealous affection."
Isn't that wonderful?
Nobody writes like that anymore, and
no.
what tremendous words of
it's
praise,
so rich,
Raymond. So he was a local celebrity, was he?
Indeed, yes, for 30 years, yes. And loved. There's a rumour and a tradition that on one particular day he promoted, conducted, sang in, visited 15 different musical events in the one day.
So he really did make his mark in the musical department of this city.
And was very, very popular with the ladies. Extremely.
Well, one of them was his pupil. I'm going to read the rest of this tributary memorial wording.
Right.
And after zealous affection, it says, "This tributary memorial was erected by his affectionate pupils, Anna Selina Storis and John Braham, prompted by their friendship and grateful respect for professional merit and liberality of sentiment. He died April the 8th, 1810, aged 62. Well, Anna Selina Storis is none other than...
Nancy Storis.
Mozart's first
Susanna, yes.
And John Braham?
Was her common law husband and the leading tenor of his day, without doubt. And taught, of course, by Rauzzini.
So that really is a tribute that two such famous singers should bother to do that.
Yes, yes, it is.
Well, by the time he settled here in Bath in 1780, Rauzzini had more or less given up singing on the grand stage. But prior to that, his life had been a whirlwind of continental travel and dazzling operatic fame. Rauzzini was born in December 1746 at Camerlano, near Rome, and he studied with Giuseppe Santarelli, the master of the Sistine Chapel Choir. He was a remarkable musician. Apparently, he could sight-read the most difficult music upside down. He was also a gifted keyboard player and composer, as well as singer. He made his professional debut in Rome at the age of 18 in a production by Niccolò Piccini, and the following year he appeared in an opera company in Venice before his reputation drew him to Munich, where he entered the service of the Elector Maximilian III, Joseph. The gracious Elector paid him an enormous fee, but also granted him leave to perform in other places. So, his debut in Vienna in 1767 caused a bit of a stir. Apparently the whole audience erupted into applause when he sang, which was contrary to the etiquette of the time and considered deeply offensive to the court. So guards were posted to prevent a further outbreak of audience rapture. But when he returned to the stage for his next aria, The audience exploded again. It was back in Venice, though, that Rautsini was heard by a 16-year-old Mozart and his father, Leopold. Rautsini's vocal talents, his stage presence and acting abilities must have persuaded the young composer that he should write for him the leading male role in his new opera, Lucio Silla, which was premiered in Milan in December 1772. We're going to hear something from that opera now. Here's another male soprano, Michael Maniaci, with Boston Baroque, and the aria is Ah, se a morir mi chiama. the aria A Se Amorir Mi Chiama from Mozart's opera Lucio Silla, performed there by Michael Maniaci with Boston Baroque, directed by Martin Perlman. Lucio Silla's initial success in Milan was unprecedented. It ran for more than 20 performances that season. And as Michael Maniaci explains now, the young Mozart was tickled pink with his leading man.
Apparently Mozart was quite delighted with his singing and very impressed with his skills. The role is very demanding. It covers about 2.5 octaves, and it not only requires very beautiful, sustained legato singing, but it requires quite a bit of very challenging fioritura, or fast-moving coloratura passages. As the result of Mozart's great excitement with this castrato, he wrote the famous motet, the Exultate Jubilate, for him as a tribute.
Michael Maniaci. The Exultate Jubilate is one of Mozart's most famous works, popular on concert programs with sopranos all over the world. I've sung it here in Bath Abbey myself. It's intriguing to think that it was actually composed with a castrato in mind. Let's hear Michael Maniaci again in part of his recording of the brilliant motet, written as a thank you gift in January 1773.
Thank you.
The opening movement of Mozart's motet Exultate Jubilate, written in January 1773 as a thank you gift for the castrato Venanzio Rossini, who'd just taken Milan by storm with his performance in Mozart's new opera Lucio Silla. Michael Maniaci was the singer, with Martin Perlman directing Boston Baroque. Particularly in the 18th century, when opera was seen simultaneously as the highest and the most popular musical art form, the leading castrati attained incredible fame across Europe. Some of them attained quite a bit of notoriety as well, but the custom of castration was actually centuries old, even before opera composers recognised the benefits of high male voices, as Michael Maniaci explains.
The practice of castration for the purposes of preserving the voice began in the church. Young boys before puberty were given the snip, as it were, so that these beautiful angelic voices could be retained as the bodies still grew and develop into these castrati, which, beginning in the church, then developed onto the operatic stage. I can't be certain of the number of castrations, but one would have to assume that it was well into the thousands. You can read about examples of rather poor families lining up, unfortunately, to have these operations done to their boys with hopes of fame and family fortune.
Talent scouts would travel all over Europe and basically buy beautiful voices of boys, gave the parents some money, they were poor, and say, we take your son to a beautiful school, he will be educated well. It was a good way giving up the responsibility and having one mouth less to feed. I mean, people were really poor then. Then there were these famous schools, and just few of these castrati ever made a big career. It was a bit glorified by this film Farinelli that gives us the impression that there were thousands of famous castrati. There were probably 10,000 of castrated boys, of which 25% died from infection during this operation, and probably two handful that made a big career.
Andreas Scholl and Michael Maniaci. Venanzio Rossini certainly did make a successful career. Acclaimed and staggeringly well-paid performances in Rome, Venice, Milan, Vienna, Munich, and then finally to London in 1774, where he sang regularly at the King's Theatre. Quite a similar career path to that of his famous Italian predecessor, Senesino.
Thank you.
Andreas Scholl and Accademia Byzantina, directed by Ottavio Dantone, in that aria from Antonio Lotti's opera Teofane, written for the famous castrato Senesino. As Andreas Scholl explains now, though, despite the worldwide fame, a castrato's life wasn't always a happy one.
What we always forget is the end of a castrato's career. There's no family, there's no wife, there's no children, so they adopted nephews or nieces, usually the nephew, in order to give away the huge amount. Well, the famous ones had huge amounts of money and estates and land. And we know from letters of some of these singers that the nephew either was greedy and his interest was for the uncle to die as soon as possible. We know that Senesino had trouble with the wife of the nephew, who hated her, him, and he was profoundly unhappy in the end of his career.
The sexuality of these castrati has been written about quite a bit. I think in addition to becoming very famous on stage, they were very famous in the bedroom as well, because they could oftentimes provide a level of sexual satisfaction that wouldn't lead to childbirth for women, or in certain situations, they could also be the subject of attention of men for people that were hiding certain practices or fearing the label of homosexual. So I think that a lot has been written about this sort of secondary career, if you will, that developed from this unfortunate process of castration for these men. Many would in fact go into prostitution.
Michael Maniaci and Andreas Scholl. Raymond Herrings, as far as I'm aware, Venanzio Rauzzini never actually turned to prostitution, but it is fair to say that he was quite a ladies' man. He was well in demand.
When he was a very young chap, one of the newspapers of the early 19th century states categorically that he was inexperienced, and it is thought perhaps that the ladies found him very attractive. Be that as it may, certainly a little later on in life, when he was about, ripe age of 20 or so, he found the ladies attractive. And he went from city to city, in demand professionally, but also in demand socially, I'm not quite sure how one should put this, for romantic reasons. The young ladies felt that he was safe to be with. He was, after all, a castrato. But there are other stories about that. It is felt that there may have been problems with husbands, cuckolded husbands, indeed. And so he was chased out of many cities, but eventually in 1774 found that Europe was too hot for him, came to London. In London, exactly the same thing occurred. Whilst here in Bath, he found that he was very much a favourite of the very elegant women, and there was a young aristocrat, Lady Gooch, who actually offered him £10,000 to go away with her. That's £1.25 million today. He must have been a rogue to have been offered that. But he didn't accept, and there was the gentleman. And I think that's what made him so attractive.
Now, I'm very interested in this idea that women, married women, it's perfectly safe for them to, shall we say, consort with the well-known castrated artist Rauzzini because he is safe. Don't worry, ladies, you're all right with me.
You're okay with me.
But you do have a theory, don't you, about Rauzzini's actual gender status. In the absence of any cast-iron information about whether any surgical intervention did take place when he was young, you're inclined to believe that actually none did and that his voice developed naturally this way.
Well, I'm quite convinced that Rauzzini was a male alto. It was that sound that he cultivated. And I think because he cultivated, and it perhaps was something of a strain at times, possibly it left him fairly early, after, say, 12 years or so, leaving him now with a magic middle and a supremely beautiful lower register to the voice, which people found very, very attractive. Added to being a very, very cultivated man and a very nice-looking man, you can see why the ladies fell for him. But you can also see why, if they fell for him and an unfortunate result occurred, that they might be able to get away with it if an elderly husband was
prevailed upon.
Or chuffed is the word, isn't it? Because he's now got a son and heir or so. But one or two may have found out or suspected that things weren't quite right. And when you're dealing with aristocracy, if that sounds illegitimate, there's trouble.
So you think it's entirely possible that there were some little Rauzzinis left to the world?
Yes, wouldn't it be wonderful to find out? Rauzzini was a very fine-looking man, perhaps one of the most beautiful of all men around at the time, as indeed Farinelli had been before him. I feel that they did play the game. Much so I admire the man and his singing and his voice and his musicianship and everything else. I think that aspect of his life is questionable.
Well, of course, we don't have castrati on our concert platforms anymore. I guess I should say it one more time. But as we've demonstrated today, there are male sopranos and countertenors treading the boards everywhere. We asked Michael Maniaci to explain the basic physiology behind his extraordinary voice.
In my case, when my voice changed, the simplest way to describe it is that my chords simply lengthened and thickened, but didn't as much as they could have. So it resulted in this naturally high instrument in a man's body and a musculature within the voice itself that is fully developed. And there haven't been a lot of examples of that within the classical community in terms of people that have cultivated a vocal skill. So it sets me apart in the sense that I seem to be one of the first guys to come along that has this natural facility. Because of that, it gives me options for dynamics, colors, and size or even range at times, which is quite a bit different than a countertenor. The singing in the falsetto, obviously with such stunning singers like David Daniels, Andrea Scholl, Philippe Jaruski, we've seen that being a falsettist is certainly not a derogatory term in any way, shape, or form. They make absolutely unbelievable sounds and sing with great color contrast and variety. In my case, it's just a completely different timbre, color, and use of the voice by virtue of not being a falsetto. So, of course, the most obvious difference would be range, in that most countertenors tend to specialize in roles written for the alto and contralto castrati, I sing roles written for the higher soprano and mezzo-soprano castrati.
Raymond, we heard earlier about some of the rather sad ends to the lives of these famous singers, but Rossini was an exception, wasn't he? He came to the most fashionable city in England.
Mm. I mean, and the most musical, yes.
And the most musical. Partly because his singing powers were beginning to diminish, but partly because he was going to make a wonderful living and a wonderful life for himself as a composer, player and a teacher.
So much so that the paper would have it, the Bath Chronicle would have it, that he was the finest of all teachers in the universe. And they listed the people that studied with him and made the point that every one of them was totally different. But this is the most important thing, that they had their own style. They loved him very much and were consummate musicians. He must have been a super teacher. Apparently he didn't charge very much, and they all came back to Bath to sing for him.
There's a charming quote in an essay by the Bath city historian Kenneth James, and here it is. Rossini's success in Bath owed much to his attractive personality. His manners were impeccable. He was generous and hospitable, both at his various townhouses and in Perimede, his country home in Widcombe. Well, Perimede is where we are right now. And when we arrived, Brian Stryker, the current owner of Perimede, who's made us so welcome this afternoon, he said, coming into this room where I'm sitting now with Raymond Herrings is like visiting Graceland. And in fact, there's a picture of Elvis, because Brian is a talented artist. There are also some guitars. So we're in the home of a musician in a fine elegant Georgian drawing room with beautiful plastered cornices. And the thing that is so exciting about this elegant room is that in 1794, Rautsini's guest was Haydn himself. Raymond, how did this visit come about?
Well, it was quite a simple one. Haydn knew Rautsini in Europe, and he decided to come down and spend some time with him. That man left London at 5:30 in a coach from 4, I suppose, had to drive over Hounslow Heath, danger, brigands, highwaymen, breakfast in Slough, and then more problems later on with highwaymen in Wiltshire. Didn't get here till 8:30, we think, in the evening. Long journey. He must have wanted to come and visit his very good friend. And they did stay together and they caroused, if that's the word, here, just where we're sitting now.
And, of course, Haydn's visit to this lovely house produced an enchanting miniature musical result.
Turk was a faithful dog, and not a man, Turk was a faithful dog.
A jolly little round by Joseph Haydn, Turk was a faithful dog, written as a thank you gift to Venanzio Rautsini in 1794. And Raymond and I are in the garden of Rautsini's house, Perimede, where until the 1920s it's known that there was a marble memorial to Rautsini's dog, Turk. So, Raymond, here we are in Rautsini's garden. It is noisier than it was in his time because yes. We're in the 21st century. In fact, it's 200 years this year since he died. Tell me about his funeral. It must have been huge.
It was indeed, probably attended by more people than had come for any of the other previous famous residents of Bath. The abbey was full to overflowing. The churchyard outside was equally full, and the streets were paved, if that's the way to put it, with people wanting to see the cortege go by and to wish him luck on his next journey. All of the music for 30 years was controlled by him, put on by him, run by him, financed in many cases by him, and certainly patronised by him in every way. A splendid man.
Well, Raymond Herrings, it's been a joy to spend the day with you here in Bath and to learn from you so much about Rautsini. I think he was an inspiring and in many ways very lovable man, and I wish I'd met him. Thanks so much for being my guest today
on
the programme.
Thank you very much.
Well, we're going to finish with a magical mix of Raymond and Rautsini, if I may put it like that. Most of Rautsini's own compositions have long been lost or forgotten, but we can end today's programme with one of his most charming songs discovered by today's guest, Raymond Herrings, in the Public Library. And it's performed here by Radu Marian with David Wright on the harpsichord. It's called The Rose.
Stella sleeps
Radu Marianne, with David Wright playing the harpsichord in that song The Rose by Venanzio Rauzzini. And it ends today's Early Music Show. It was presented by Catherine Bott and produced in Manchester by Les Pratt.
In Friday's performance on 3, a double bill of Monteverdi concerts from the Spitalfields Festival. In the first, the 16 and Harry Christophers perform some of the composer's most vivacious sacred music. Then in the second, Julian Joseph joins in for Monteverdi with a little embellishment.
Freedom within the music is something I think Monteverdi would have been familiar with. And on Friday, Mark Hodgson, the 16 and I will see how far we can take the idea of Baroque jazz synthesis.
Monteverdi as you've never heard him before, in performance on 3, Friday night from 7 o'clock, here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this Sunday afternoon. It's a little after 2 o'clock. And now here's Chichi Nwanoku with more of your requests.
And here's a curiosity to start us off today. An Irish pastoral idyll set by an English composer and sung by a choir from the heart of America's Midwest. The Lake Isle of Innisfree by Granville Bantock, sung there by the St. Louis Chamber Chorus, directed by Philip Barnes. That track is from their new CD entitled A Pageant of Human Life on the Regent label. I played it for Helen Watt. Many thanks. Next, Suzanne Winter in Wistaston, Cheshire, has emailed to say how much she's enchanted by the voice of the young English soprano Elizabeth Watts. And having heard her sing Schubert recently on Radio 3, she'd love to hear more. Well, Suzanne, I'd be delighted. Schubert's songs are always extremely welcome here. This is from Elizabeth Watts's first collection of his Lieder, accompanied by Roger Vignoles. We'll hear six songs. Frühlingsglaube and Im Abendrot are full of the hopes of a new year and the soft glow of the setting sun, while the next, rarely heard song, Aus Diego Manzanares, is full of Spanish guitar-like chords in the piano. And Die Nachtigall, a heartfelt plea to the nightingale not to disturb two lovers' tryst, follows, before the song that Brahms acclaimed as the loveliest ever written, Zuleika. And to finish, well, you'll see.